of the population during Obama, but our calculations are it'll be 2024 before we see that at the ballot box. America's political geography through the structure of the Senate, the drawing of House districts, and the composition of the Electoral College further amplifies the power of whiter, more rural, more Christian voters, giving that coalition more political power than sheer demographics would predict. But cultural power runs a decade or more ahead of demography, with brands and television networks chasing younger, more urban, more diverse consumers. That's why it's become a veritable Super Bowl tradition to wade through controversy over some venerable brand's surprisingly woke ads. In 2019, for instance, Gillette released a pre-Super Bowl ad showing boys roughhousing, men touching women inappropriately in corporate boardrooms, and an in-night chorus of barbecuing dads excusing the behavior with "boys will be boys." In a twist on Gillette's tagline, the commercial asked, "Is this the best a man can get?" The backlash was swift. Men are saying, "We feel marginalized, criticized and accused rather than feeling inspired, empowered and encouraged," a branding executive told the Wall Street Journal. "We are taking a realistic look at what's happening today, and aiming to inspire change by acknowledging that the old saying 'boys will be boys' is not an excuse," responded Pankaj Bala, Gillette's brand director for North America. 18 for Gillette, this wasn't truly a controversy. It was a business decision. Brands want to be where the culture is going, not where it's been. But most people live in the culture rather than protein from it, and they experience the changing mores reacted in ads and movie casts as a shift in power that either excites or unnerves them. The result is that the left feels a cultural and demographic power that it can only occasionally translate into political power, and the right wields political power but feels increasingly dismissed and upended culturally. This is the crucial context for Trump's rise, and it's why Tesler has little patience for those who treat Trump as an invader in the Republican Party. In an eld of Republicans who were trying to change the party to appeal to a rising Hispanic electorate, Trump was alone in speaking to Republican voters who didn't want the party to remake itself, who wanted to be told that a wall could be built and things could go back to the way they were. Trump met the party where it was rather than trying to change it, Tesler says. He was hunting where the ducks were. 19 White identity under threat. One way of looking at Trump is as a disruptive force that crashed, like a once-in-a-generation comet, into American politics. But the other way of looking at Trump, the correct way, is as a master marketer who astutely read the market. Conservative politics was becoming more racialized in response to Obama and the changes he represented. During this period, Trump was testing the waters by championing birther conspiracy theories. The water was warm. 220 It's worth taking a moment to consider the kinds of rhetoric that conservatives had been hearing, the rhetoric that created the context for Trump. In 2009, Rush Limbaugh went on the air to tell his listeners, "How do you get promoted in a Barack Obama administration? By hating white people, or even saying you do, or that they're not good, or whatever. Make white people the new oppressed minority, and they are going along with it, because they're shutting up. They're moving to the back of the bus. They're saying I can't use that drinking fountain, okay. I can't use that restroom, okay." That's the modern-day Republican Party, the equivalent of the Old South, the new oppressed minority. 21 In 2012, on the evening of the election, Bill O'Reilly, then the top-rated cable news anchor in the country, sat down to tell his viewers what this all meant, because it's a changing country, the demographics are changing. It's not a traditional America anymore. And there are 50% of the voting public who wants to, they want things. And who is going to give them things? President Obama. He knows it, and he ran on it. And, whereby 20 years ago President Obama would have been roundly defeated by an establishment candidate like Mitt Romney, the white establishment is now the minority. 22 Nor did Obama's exit from the scene and Trump's election to the White House calm these sentiments. If anything, it unleashed them. The lesson conservative broadcasters took from Trump was to say the quiet part loud, and they did. In 2018, Laura Ingraham said, "In some parts of the country, it does seem like the America that we know and love doesn't exist anymore. Massive demographic changes have been foisted upon the American people. And they're changes that none of us ever voted for and most of us don't like. From Virginia to California, we see stark examples of how radically in some ways the country has changed. Now much of this is related to both illegal, and in some cases, legal immigration that, of course, progressives love. Read that again. It does seem like the America that we know and love doesn't exist anymore. Let it sink in. But her colleague Tucker Carlson wasn't saying anything different. How precisely is diversity our strength? Since you've made this our new national motto, please be specific as you explain it. Can you think, for example, of other institutions such as, I don't know, marriage or military units, in which the less people have in common the more cohesive they are? Do you get along better with your neighbors or your co-workers if you can't understand each other or share no common values? How about this question, after spending two centuries overcoming our country's painful history of racial discrimination and hatred, why is it once again acceptable, even encouraged to attack people on the basis of their skin color? Just so we're all on the same page, the skin color Carlson is saying it's okay to attack is white. He is, indeed, making an explicit comparison between the racial discrimination and hatred faced by white Americans in 2019 and that faced by black Americans through American history. It would be easy to dismiss these comments as the over-the-top rantings of pundits, but Limbaugh, O'Reilly, Ingram, and Carlson's views are widely shared. A 2016 Public Religion Research Institute poll found that 57% of whites agreed that discrimination against whites is as big a problem today as discrimination against blacks and other minorities. 23. A 2017 Gen Forward poll of white millennials found 48% agreed with a similar statement, showing that the sentiment isn't con-ed or even concentrated among older whites. In 2012, Romney chose to run a campaign mainly based on class identity, pitting his vision of the heroic entrepreneur against Obama's emphasis on the screwed-over worker. He lost, buried under surging non-white turnout. In the aftermath of his defeat, Republicans began obsessing over how to win non-white voters. The Republican National Committee even commissioned an autopsy of the election, which concluded, if Hispanic Americans perceive that a GOP nominee or candidate does not want them in the United States, i.e. self-deportation, they will not pay attention to our next sentence. It does not matter what we say about education, jobs, or the economy, if Hispanics think we do not want them here, they will close their ears to our policies. In the last election, Governor Romney received just 27% of the Hispanic vote. Other minority communities, including Asian and Pacific Islander Americans, also view the party as unwelcoming. President Bush got 44% of the Asian vote in 2004, our presidential nominee received only 26% in 2012. The report went on to recommend embracing comprehensive immigration reform, elevating Hispanic leaders inside the Republican Party, and being inclusive and welcoming in both fact and deed. Otherwise, it warned, our party's appeal will continue to shrink to its core constituencies only. But there were dissenting voices. The political analyst Sean Trend wrote an influential analysis of the results in Real Clear Politics, arguing that almost 7 million fewer whites voted in 2012 than in 2008-24. It was mobilizing these missing white voters, Trend said, that offered Republicans a quicker path back to power. That was the path Trump chose, but he was following a trail that was already cut into the electorate. You can think of politics as a market, and powerful, primal forces like white identity as representing a market opportunity. Eventually, someone was going to come along and give the Republican base what they wanted. If Trump hadn't done it in 2016, another politician would have in 2020 or 2024. The pressure was just going to keep building. Ashley Jardina is a political scientist at Duke University who studies racial identity. In her book White Identity Politics, she argues that generations of scholars have taken African American, Hispanic, and Asian identity seriously but assumed there was no such thing as white identity. When considering whether white Americans feel a sense of anxiety about the status of their racial group, or whether whites possess a sense of racial identity that has political consequences, for the past 50 years, the answer generally has been no, she writes. For the most part, scholars have argued that racial solidarity among whites has been invisible and politically inconsequential. Whites, by nature of their dominant status and numerical majority, have largely been able to take their race for granted. 25 Jardinus shows that this was wrong. White political identity is conditional. It emerges in periods of threat and challenges periods like this one. Demographic change, the election of the RST black president, and the downstream cultural and political consequences of both have led a sizable proportion of whites to believe that their racial group, and the BANI-TS that group enjoys, are endangered. As a result, this racial solidarity now plays a central role in the way many whites orient themselves to the political and social world. There is a nuance to Jardinus' research worth noting. A sense of racial identity can be based on in-group favoritism or out-group hostility. Both can be, and often are, present, but Jardinus repeatedly ends that much of the strengthening of white political identity is a defense of white political privilege without an attendant rise in racist attitudes. To some, this will sound like a distinction without a deference, but it's meaningful in how people experience their own politics and what kinds of appeals and messages they respond to. Jardinus ends that about 30-40% of the white population feels a strong, and growing, sense of racial solidarity, but most of them feel it without an accompanying sense of racial hostility. That helps explain a strength and a weakness in Trump's political approach. His cocktail of white identity politics and outright bigotry mixes popular components, like a focus on protecting native-born whites from both immigrant competition and foreign competition, with unpopular displays of racism and bigotry. A savvier politician than Trump could focus on defending white privileges without constantly crossing into outright racism, and prove far more politically formidable. There are lessons here for Trump's opponents. Two, you can craft a message and policies to calm the fears powering white identity politics, or you can mobilize your base in ways that aggravate white voters. In 2006, Nilla Branscom, Michael Schmidt, and Kristen Schehauer published a fascinating paper called Racial Attitudes in Response to Thoughts of White Privilege. They found that priming white college students to think about the concept of white privilege led them to express more racial resentment in subsequent surveys. The simplest way to activate someone's identity is to threaten it, to tell them they don't deserve what they have, to make them consider that it might be taken away. The experience of losing status and being told your loss of status is part of society's march to justice is itself radicalizing. There's a quote I occasionally see ricochet around social media. When you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. 26 There's truth to this line, but it cuts both ways. To the extent that it's true that a loss of privilege feels like oppression, that feeling needs to be taken seriously, both because it's real, and because, left to fester, it can be weaponized by demagogues and reactionaries. In her book Talking to Strangers, Harvard political theorist Danielle Allen writes that the hard truth of democracy is that some citizens are always giving things up for others. These sacrifices, she argues, are subjective, but they need to be treated as sine qua, and met with a spirit of political friendship. In a conversation I had with her for my podcast, Allen expanded on the point. We need to give each other space to negotiate around experiences of loss, she said. But more is demanded of winners in any given political moment, it is the job of the winner to make the ongoing possibility of a political friendship real. What makes that such a difficult principle to adhere to is that the question of who counts as a winner at any given moment is hard to answer, and American politics is often a chorus of contradictory voices persuasively claiming victimhood at the same time. Most of us are winners in some ways and losers in others, and we feel the losses more acutely than the victories. Making matters worse, the losses that stem from demographic change are difficult to talk about, and they are often cloaked in more socially acceptable, and politically defensible, language. How demographic threat drives economic anxiety. Talk of white identity politics makes many uncomfortable. There is another explanation some prefer for Trump's rise, an explanation that accounts for the turmoil of our politics without forcing us into uncomfortable conversations about race, power, and resentment. That explanation? It's the economy, stupid. As the argument goes, the financial crisis, the rise of automation, the wreckage of globalization, the pain of the Great Recession, the shocking run-up in inequality, all of that was more than enough to upend our politics. You don't need to reach for racialized explanations. A bitter debate erupted after the 2016 election between those who blame our politics on economic anxiety and those who see a country riven by racial resentment. In its aftermath, a popular synthesis has emerged: economic anxiety activated racial resentment, which means, comfortingly, that a better economy will calm our divisions. The best evidence we have suggests the synthesis is right, but we're getting the causality backward. In their book Identity Crisis, the 2016 presidential campaign and the battle for the meaning of America, political scientists John Seitz, Michael Tesler, and Lynn Vavreck analyze reams of data and show that racial resentment activated economic anxiety, rather than the other way around. Before Obama's presidency, how Americans felt about black people did not much affect their perceptions of the economy. After Obama, this changed. In December 2007, racial resentment, which captures whether Americans think differences in black culture are the main reason for racial inequality, was not related to whites' perceptions of whether the economy was getting better or worse, after accounting for partisanship and ideology. But when these exact same people were re-interviewed in July 2012, racial resentment was a powerful predictor of economic perceptions. The greater someone's level of racial resentment, the worse they believed the economy was doing. 27. This is unnerving data, as we tend to imagine the economy as a rare subject on which objective facts, rather than group conists, drive opinions. Sadly, no. Seitz, Tesler, and Vavreck analyzed polling on economic sentiment and found that Republicans in the highest income quintile, those making more than $100,000 per year, were actually slightly less satisfied than Democrats in the lowest income quintile, those making less than $20,000 per year. In general, economic anxiety did not predict which candidate people voted for, and what relationship did exist was no stronger in 2016 than in 2012. This was borne out in the election's aftermath. According to Gallup's polls, Trump's election led to a remarkable 80-point jump in economic confidence among Republicans and a 37-point fall among Democrats. The economy since Trump took office has mostly shown the same trends from the NAL years of Obama: job growth, in fact, has been slightly slower, but his coalition's confidence continued to soar, even as they lived under much the same economy that so depressed them in 2016. Indeed, new data collected by Tesler shows that the most racially resentful are now the most economically optimistic. This pattern holds internationally, too. The rise of the populist right is not a uniquely American phenomenon, and it did not begin in 2016. It has manifested in countries across the Western world. It has gathered force in good economic times and bad, in countries with generous social safety nets and stingy ones. Far-right party platforms differ from country to country, including on major social issues like feminism and economic issues like the size of the welfare state, wrote Vox's Zach Beecham in a careful review of the literature. The one issue every single one agrees on is hostility to immigration, particularly when the immigrants are non-white and Muslim. 28. Another problem for the economic anxiety hypothesis is that the victories of the populist right have been much more striking and widespread than those of the populist left. Plenty of countries feature political parties airing ambitious economic agendas designed in response to the financial crisis. It takes a special kind of condescension to believe voters so erring economically are so distracted by the identity politics of the right that they have overlooked the direct solutions to the economic problems aired by the left. Anyone who wants to explain what's happening in the West needs to answer two simple questions, writes the political scientist Eric Kaufman in his book White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. First, why are right-wing populists doing better than left-wing ones? Second, Why did the migration crisis boost populist right numbers sharply while the economic crisis had no overall EECT? If we stick to data, the answer is crystal clear. Demography and culture, not economic and political developments, hold the key to understanding the populist moment. 29. None of this takes away from the fact that economic anxiety is real, or that more broadly shared economic growth would be good for our politics. But it does suggest economic anxiety cannot explain away our political or cultural divisions. Indeed, Trump himself is proof of this. He calls the economy under his watch a miracle, but that has not led him or his supporters toward a gentler stance on immigration or less concern over NFL players kneeling to protest police brutality. A better economy would be good for the country because a better economy would always be good for the country. But it will not allow us to vault over the decolletize of a Browning, secularizing America. What the political correctness wars are really about, there's a story. Jennifer Richeson, the Yale psychologist responsible for some of the studies discussed above, told me about the building she works in. My lab is an old engineering building and there's exactly one women's bathroom, she said with a laugh. No one noticed that, or at least no faculty members did. 30 And then, slowly, Yale began adding women to the department, and they noticed it. They complained. Now there was friction. What had gone unnoticed by those with power in one era was unacceptable to those gaining power in another. When new people show up, they notice new things and start asking questions and begin making demands, she says. There's been an obsessive interest in recent years in conists over political correctness. Tune into Fox News on any given night and you'll end yourself dropped into a controversy on some liberal arts college somewhere. The connective tissue of the intellectual dark web, the anxiety that has made a coalition of new atheist Sam Harris, conservative pundit Ben Shapiro, Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson, and others is fear that the boundaries of acceptable discourse are being narrowed, that PC culture and identity politics are choking free speech. There's a whole subgenre of punditry arguing that Trump's rise is a regrettable, but predictable, backlash to political correctness, and thus the blame for his emergence properly belongs to campus activists and Black Lives Matter protesters. These fears can seem bizarre at first glance. Given all the other things available to worry about in the world, who cares what happened at this or that college? But the speed with which these clashes go viral on Twitter and Facebook, the enthusiasm with which they're covered on cable news and trashy-hungry websites and celebrated podcasts, all RECT the reality that something deeper and more fearful in us is being activated. These are proxy wars for bigger, more fundamental concerns over the direction of the culture. The theory is that as go elite college campuses, so goes the nation. This is particularly true for those who make a portion of their income giving speeches on college campuses. Whatever you think of that theory, the issues being raised are fundamental. What can you say without being criticized? Protested? Punished? Who gets forgiven and who gets ostracized? What are the lines, and who gets to decide where they're drawn? Trump harnessed these sentiments during the campaign. I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct, he said. I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't, frankly, have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time, either. Much of this debate has played out under false pretenses. The idea that college campuses have ever been bastions of free speech is a shame. In October 2017, Sean Decatur, the RST African American president of Kenyon College, noted that American colleges have always believed the regulation of civility and behavioral norms to be part of their mandate. He quoted Kenyon's statement of student responsibilities from the 1960s, which warned that any behavior that offends the sensibilities of others, whether students, faculty members, or visitors, will result in disciplinary action. Vulgar behavior, obscene language, or disorderly conduct are not tolerated. 31 This was, he continued, far stricter than anything that 21st century critics of higher education see as a product of political correctness. So what's changed? The answer, Decatur suggested, is who gets to decide what counts as offensive behavior, the demographics of elite, residential colleges has changed drastically in the last 50 years and, as a result, the definition of civility has begun to change. There are many, including myself, who see the act of whites dressing in blackface as a disrespectful act. Reminding students of the norms of civil, respectful behavior, including refraining from blackface, is in line with the actions of colleges historically. What has changed is not the expectation that colleges do any norms for civility, but rather the definition of civility. There are behaviors on college campuses in general, and at Kenyon in particular, that may have passed a standard for civility 50 years ago when the institution was all male and almost all white that would not be considered civil today. 32 It is easy to read that as pure progress, but for those who dominated the discourse before, it represents real loss, and for everyone involved, it carries confusion and upheaval. New lines are being drawn, but no one is quite sure where they are or who is doing the drawing. The power to define the boundaries of acceptable behavior and polite discourse is profound, and right now, it is contested. I call it the democratization of discomfort, says Richeson. There were whole swaths of people uncomfortable all of the time. Now we're democratizing it. Now more people across different races and religions feel uncomfortable. The point here is not that college activists never go too far, of course they do. That's almost the point of being a college activist. The point is that we typically don't care what happens on college campuses. In this case, Campus ConICT is a window into the larger conists cutting through our society. It's a hothouse atmosphere where GHTs take place with particular clarity, as the moderating forces of non-college life keeping your job, barely having time to go to the gym, much less to political protests, are lifted. But on all sides, the debate over PC culture is really about the core questions of not just politics but life, whose grievances get heard. Who gets to be referred to by the names and labels and pronouns they choose. Who grants respectability, and who takes it away. Put more simply, in a changing America, who holds power? New York Times columnist Brett Stevens is a good example. He's written column after column slamming the delicate sensitivities of the campus left. He's tweeted that the right to own is the most precious right. Without it, free speech is meaningless. 33 He's lamented the way millennials exact professional destruction as the price for emotional upset. 34 But then the New York Times got a bedbug infestation, and George Washington University professor Dave Karpf sent a little noticed tweet joking that the bedbugs are a metaphor. The bedbugs are Brett Stevens. 35 Furious. The columnist sent an angry email to Karpf, CCing his provost, and sent a separate email to the director of GWU's School of Media and Public Affairs. 36 It was the definition of trying to exact professional destruction as vengeance for emotional upset. Stevens's overreaction was hypocritical and unwise. He quit Twitter shortly thereafter. But the outburst was the culmination of hurts Stevens had been nurturing for years. Stevens's columns frequently offend the Times's liberal readers, and he's a constant target of mockery on Twitter. In May 2019, Stevens struck back with a column entitled Dear Millennials, The Feeling is Mutual, where he wrote that no faction on the Democratic side more richly deserves rebuking than these younger generations that specialize in histrionic self-pity and moral self-righteousness, usually communicated via social media with maximum snark. 37 The personal is political, indeed. Stevens had far more power and clout than his critics, but humans are social animals, exquisitely tuned to agonize over criticism and obsess over insult. Stevens had been vibrating with fury at how he was treated online. He wanted some higher authority to enforce a more civil tone toward him, personally. The right to own may be precious, but the endless experience of offense is crushing. In a past decade, Stevens's role at the Times might have insulated him from this kind of public assault. He wielded a national platform, while his daily critics would have been left penning angry letters to the editor, but those days had passed. For Stevens, as for so many others in this era, the objective fact of his power did not translate into him feeling powerful. But when he tried to act on his experience of being bullied, he proved the bully. Thus are the disorientations of the age. It's become common to mock students demanding safe spaces, but look carefully at the collisions in American politics right now and UND that everyone is demanding safe spaces. The fear is not that the government is regulating speech but that protesters are chilling speech, that Twitter mobs rove the land looking for an errant word or misread joke. In our eagerness to discount our opponents as easily triggered snowflakes, we've lost sight of the animating impulse behind much of politics and, indeed, much of life, the desire to feel safe, to know you can say what you want without fear. In a telling postscript, Stevens initially agreed to a debate with Karpf at George Washington University on the topic of civility in the media, but pulled out when Gwu insisted on making the debate open to the public. 38 How demographic change changes our parties as America changes, so, too, do the issues America chooses to confront and the ways it chooses to confront them. In 1996, as President Clinton swept to re-election, the Democratic Party platform included a section on immigration that sounds as if it could have been released by the Trump administration today. Today's Democratic Party also believes we must remain a nation of laws. We cannot tolerate illegal immigration and we must stop it. 4 years before Bill Clinton became president, Washington talked tough but failed to act. In 1992, our borders might as well not have existed. The border was under-patrolled, and what patrols there were under-equipped. Drugs owed freely. Illegal immigration was rampant. Criminal immigrants, deported after committing crimes in America, returned the very next day to commit crimes again. President Clinton is making our border a place where the law is respected and drugs and illegal immigrants are turned away. We have increased the border patrol by over 40%, in El Paso. Our border patrol agents are so close together they can see each other. Last year alone, the Clinton administration removed thousands of illegal workers from jobs across the country. Just since January of 1995, we have arrested more than 1,700 criminal aliens and prosecuted them on federal felony charges because they returned to America after having been deported. Fast forward to the 2016 Democratic Party platform. Another Clinton was running for president, but the party was much more reliant on Hispanic votes. Democrats believe we need to urgently X our broken immigration system which tears families apart and keeps workers in the shadows and create a path to citizenship for law-abiding families who are here, making a better life for their families and contributing to their communities and our country. WE will defend and implement President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals and Deferred Action for Parents of Americans executive actions to help Dreamers, parents of citizens, and lawful permanent residents avoid deportation. We will build on these actions to provide relief for others, such as parents of Dreamers. We believe immigration enforcement must be humane and consistent with our values. We should prioritize those who pose a threat to the safety of our communities, not hard-working families who are contributing to their communities. We will end raids and roundups of children and families, which unnecessarily sow fear in immigrant communities. In 1996, white voters were more closely split between the two parties, the Hispanic vote was smaller, and both parties were more skeptical of immigration. In 2016, white voters were concentrated in the Republican Party, Hispanic voters were far more powerful, and this cut a political schism in which Democrats became friendlier to immigrants and Republicans nominated Trump. This is a dynamic Tesler describes well. In the post-civil rights era, Democrats needed to maintain their non-white base without alienating white voters, he told me. So their incentive was silence. And Republicans needed to win over white voters without appearing racist. So their incentive was to speak about race in code. The shifts now have made it so Democrats' incentive is to make explicitly pro-racial equality appeals and Republicans now have an incentive to make more explicit anti-minority appeals. 39 But it's not just that Democrats need a racial justice agenda to appeal to their non-white base. In another example of the way stacking identities and changing demographics shift opinion, they increasingly need it to appeal to their white base, too. In 1994, 39% of Democrats and 26% of Republicans said discrimination was the main reason black people can't get ahead these days. By 2017, 64% of Democrats believed that, but only 14% of Republicans. Much of this trend has been driven by white Democrats. In the past few years, white liberals have moved so far to the left on questions of race and racism that they are now, on these issues, to the left of even the typical black voter, writes Vox's Matt Iglesias, in an analysis of what he calls the Great Awakening. 40 Strikingly, white liberals are now less likely than African Americans to say that black people should be able to get ahead without any special help. Part of being a Democrat today, and particularly a white Democrat, is a commitment to racial equality, built on an understanding of systemic racism as a central scourge. As political demography changes, so do political identities. Take that idea and extend it out into the coming decades of American politics. The Democratic Party will not be able to win elections without an excited, diverse coalition. The Republican Party will not be able to win elections without an enthused white base. Democrats will need to build a platform that's even more explicit in its pursuit of racial and gender equality, while Republicans will need to design a politics even more responsive to a coalition that feels itself losing power. This dynamic is behind much of the panic about identity politics. When a single group dominates the political agenda, its grievances and demands are just coded as politics, and the vast majority of policy is designed in response to its concerns. But that changes when no one group can control the agenda but many groups can push items onto it, then the competition among identity-based groups becomes visible. It wasn't called identity politics when every cabinet member of every administration was a white male. It's only identity politics when there's pressure to diversify appointments. And yet that process doesn't re-ect a strengthening of a particular identity group's hold on politics but a weakening of it. In June of 2018, I went to Los Angeles to interview Mayor Eric Garcetti. I asked him how, in a diverse polity, he dealt with the tensions of what some call identity politics and what some just call politics. His answer? Talk less, act more. I came in here as mayor, he said, and I looked at the boards and commissions that I appointed, about 300 people to oversee our departments. And within 6 months, I made them, for the RST time, over 50% women. I think it was 53 or 54% women. And then we could get back to business. 41 But imagine that at the national level, attempted by the RST female president, with a polarized media looking for CONICT. Many would celebrate it. Others would see discrimination, threat, loss. Think back to Limbaugh saying, how do you get promoted in a Barack Obama administration? By hating white people. Think of Jordan Peterson labeling Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's efforts to promote gender equality a murderous equity doctrine. 42 The world is not zero-sum, but it is sometimes zero-sum. A world in which 50% of government appointees are female is a world in which fewer are male. Those losses will be felt and fought. Powerful social movements will arise to protect what is being taken, to justify the way things were before. Society often appears calm when fundamental injustices go unchallenged, but even if that were desirable and it's not, it will be impossible as historically marginalized groups gain the power to demand their share of the American dream. As we navigate these sensitivities, we can do so with more or less care. Richeson believes it would be wise for demographers to stop using terms like majority-minority America. After all, whites will still be a plurality, and what good can come of framing America's trajectory in a way that leaves the single largest group feeling maximally threatened? It sounds like a force of non-white people who are coming and they are working as a coalition to overturn white people and whiteness, Richeson says. That's a problem. 43 Richeson's research shows that if you can add reassurance to discussions of demographic change, telling people, for instance, that the shifts are unlikely to upend existing power or economic arrangements, the sense of threat, and the tilt toward racial and political conservatism, vanishes. The problem, she admits, is we can't say, don't worry, white people, you'll be okay and you'll get to run everything forever. The other problem is that the conversation about, and the experience of, a Browning America will not be driven by demographers and social psychologists, it will be driven by politicians looking for an edge, by political pundits looking for ratings, by outrageous stories going viral on social media, by cultural controversies like Gamergate and Roseanne Barr getting red. It will absorb even GERs who might prefer not to talk much about race. Bernie Sanders is a good example here. In 2016, he centered his campaign on class and was criticized for a tin ear on race. Ultimately, he won slightly more white votes than Clinton, but was swamped by her 50-point margin among African Americans. 44 in 2020, Sanders has run a more race-conscious campaign, emphasizing his past as a civil rights activist. I protested housing discrimination, was arrested for protesting school segregation, and one of the proudest days of my life was attending the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he said in his announcement speech. His campaign has hired more non-white staffers, worked harder to build relationships with black political leaders, and released plans to address the VE central types of violence waged against black, brown, and indigenous Americans. Physical, political, legal, economic, and environmental. 45 Nor is it just race. Sanders had long been skeptical of immigration's EECT on native-born workers. He opposed a 2007 bill that included a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants on the grounds that it permitted too many guest workers who would compete with Americans for jobs. In 2015, while interviewing Sanders, I asked him about open borders, a policy that many democratic socialists support, even if only aspirationally. Sanders responded with disgust. Open borders? No, that's a Koch brothers proposal. That's a right-wing proposal, which says essentially there is no United States. It would make everybody in America poorer. 46 Open borders is usually seen as a left-wing idea, but Sanders' dismissal re-echoed a long-standing skepticism of overly liberal immigration policies as bad for American workers. In the 2020 primary, however, Sanders endorsed decriminalizing unauthorized border entry and providing public health insurance to unauthorized immigrants. Sanders's evolution on these issues re-echoes both the broader trajectory of white American liberals and the strategic incentives facing any candidate trying to win the Democratic primary. Joe Biden, for his part, spent much of the early primary praising Obama's leadership while distancing himself from the Obama administration's early deportations, a policy Obama himself had disavowed by the end of his presidency. Being a National Democrat in 2020 means holding positions on race and immigration that would have been considered lethal as recently as 2008. To say American politics is in for demographic turbulence is not to say we are in for dissolution. A majority of Americans, though not of Republicans, believe the browning of America is a good thing for the country. And we have watched states like California and Texas transition into majority-minority status without falling to pieces. Politicians able to articulate a vision of this future that is inclusive, inspiring, and non-threatening, the mixture Obama sought in 2008 will reap massive rewards. But as Obama found after he was elected, leadership in this era requires delivering for diverse coalitions, taking sides in charged cultural battles, and thus becoming part of the very con-ICT you're trying to calm. The cycle of unity giving way to con-ICT, of hope about the future activating fear about the present, is likely to continue. And as long as much of the country feels threatened by the changes they see, there will be a continuing, and perhaps growing, market for politicians like Trump. It's worth noting that these dynamics cut in the other direction, too. A 2016 study by Alexander Kuo, Neil Malhotra, and Cecilia Hyun-Yung Mo split a sample of Asian American college students into two groups. One group was subjected to a staged microaggression during the study. Their U.S. citizenship was doubted by the researcher managing the experiment. The incident sparked a sharp shift toward support of the Democratic Party. Two, there's an interesting debate about whether Trump became a culture warrior out of calculation or authentic fury. After Romney lost in 2012, Trump criticized him for telling undocumented immigrants to self-deport and argued for a gentler GOP. The Democrats didn't have a policy for dealing with illegal immigrants, but what they did have going for them is they weren't mean-spirited about it, he told Newsmax. They didn't know what the policy was, but what they were is they were kind. 3. The origination of this quote is unclear, but ironically, given how popular the line has become as a feminist riposte, the earliest antecedent that quote investigator could ND was from a 1997 Usenet message board missive by Mike Jabet, which read, "Women like her are suffering from a condition I call advanced pedestalism. Which basically means that they women have been living on the high side for so long, equality looks like oppression." Interlude. What I've tried to do in the RST half of this book is build a model of what's driven American politics into its current place of bitter polarization. Let's take a moment to put it all together. The human mind is exquisitely tuned to group alienation and group deherence. It takes almost nothing for us to form a group identity, and once that happens, we naturally assume ourselves in competition with other groups. The deeper our commitment to our group becomes, the more determined we become to make sure our group wins. Making matters worse, winning is positional, not material. We often prefer outcomes that are worse for everyone so long as they maximize our group's advantage over other groups. The parties used to be scrambled, both ideologically and demographically, in ways that curbed their power as identities and lowered the partisan stakes of politics. But these ideologically mixed parties were an unstable equilibrium reacting America's peculiar, and often abhorrent, racial politics. The success of the civil rights movement, and its alliance with the National Democratic Party, broke that equilibrium, destroyed the Dixiecrat wing of the Democratic Party, and triggered an era of party sorting. That sorting has been ideological. Democrat now means liberal and Republican now means conservative in a way that wasn't true in, say, 1955. The rise in partisanship is, in part, a rational response to the rise in party deherence. If the two sides hated and feared each other less FTY years ago, well, that makes sense, they were more similar FTY years ago. But that sorting has also been demographic. Today, the parties are sharply split across racial, religious, geographic, cultural, and psychological lines. There are many, many powerful identities lurking in that list, and they are fusing together, stacking atop one another, so a con-ICT or threat that activates one activates all. And since these mega-identities stretch across so many aspects of our society, they are constantly being activated, and that means they are constantly being reinforced. All this is happening in an era of profound, powerful social change. A majority of infants born today are non-white. The fastest growing religious identity is no religious identity at all. Women make up majorities on college campuses. Soon, a record proportion of America's population will be foreign-born. Groups that are rising in power want their needs reacted in politics and culture. Groups that feel themselves losing power want to protect the status and privileges they've had, and this con-ICT is sorting itself neatly into two parties. Obama's presidency was an example of the younger, more diverse coalition taking power. Trump's presidency represented the older, whiter coalition taking it back. The second half of the book is about the relationship between a more polarized public and more polarized political institutions. In particular, I want to show the feedback loop of polarization: institutions polarize to appeal to a more polarized public, which further polarizes the public, which forces the institutions to polarize further, and so on. Polarization isn't something that happened to American politics. It's something that's happening to American politics. And it's getting worse. Chapter 6: The Media Divide Beyond Left-Right. I've been a political journalist for more than 15 years. In that time, I've been a blogger, a newspaper reporter, a magazine writer, a long-form editor, an opinion columnist, a cable news host, a social media personality, a viral video star, a podcaster, and a media entrepreneur. I launched Wonk Blog, the online policy vertical at the Washington Post, and I was a co-founder and the RST editor-in-chief of the explanatory news organization Vox, which now reaches more than 50 million people each month. When I was launching Vox, I often got asked who our competitors were. I the answer people expected me to give was other politics-heavy news and analysis sites. The Atlantic. Nate Silver's 538. The Washington Post. But the truth was that other news sites were less competitors than they were collaborators in a shared effort to engage people in politics. If silver converted a sports fan into a politics junkie, that person became instantly more likely to read Vox's political coverage. But if someone wasn't interested in politics, or was just sociently more interested in, for example, gardening tips or rewatching old friends' clips on YouTube, then that person was lost to us. I say all this to give my next sentence some weight. The central truth I've learned about the audience in each and every one of those places is almost no one is forced to follow politics. There are some lobbyists and government affairs professionals who need to stay on the cutting edge of legislative and regulatory developments to do their jobs. But most people who follow politics do so as a hobby, they follow it in the way they follow a sport or a band. We can't rely on people to read us out of duty, we have to compete with literally everything else for their attention. Rachel Maddow is at war with reruns of The Big Bang Theory. Vox's YouTube channel competes with Xbox games. Time spent reading this book is time not spent listening to the podcast serial. The logic of this extends to the very edges of our conscious life and beyond. Net9's CEO Reed Hastings famously said his biggest competitor is sleep. This is the context in which modern political journalism is produced and absorbed, an all-out war for the time of an audience that has more choices than at any point in history. This is another moment when I need to stop and state, this is new. As banal and inevitable as a competitive media market feels to those of us existing within it, it's never existed before, not like this. Consider the options available to eager political news consumers in 1995. They might have had a hometown paper or two, a handful of radio stations, the three nightly newscasts, the newly launched CNN, and, if they were really hardcore, a couple of magazine subscriptions. Fast forward a decade. Those same consumers could re-up Internet Explorer and read almost any newspaper in the country and most of the major newspapers of the world online. For political opinion, they had a dizzying array of magazines, any op-ed page they chose, and, all of a sudden, a countless number of blogs. On television, CNN had been joined by Fox News and MSNBC. On radio, satellite began crowding the airwaves with more political commentary. In pockets, the launch of the iPod kicked off the age of podcasting. This smorgasbord of news about the present was nothing compared with the explosion of information about the past. Prior to the digital revolution, virtually all available political news was remorselessly ephemeral, a newspaper article, magazine feature, or news broadcast from 6 months ago might be preserved in some library somewhere, but so far as the average news consumer was concerned, it was gone. If you heard a term you didn't know or caught a reference to a historical event you were hazy on, there were few options for snap enlightenment. The information in front of you, and physically located nearby, was all the instant information you had. By the mid-aughts, that was no longer true. Media organizations had uploaded vast archives, they were linking back to old stories, they had internal search engines, and, more important, they had made everything available to Google. If you wanted to read up on something that happened a year ago or 10 years ago, it was all there for you, even if all you knew was some general words pointing toward the subject. Never in human history had it been remotely possible to be this politically informed. In most models of democratic politics, information is the constraint. Voters don't have the time or energy to read thick tomes of political theory and keep themselves updated on every act of Congress, so they're dependent on the political professionals elected OCHALs, campaign operatives, party staffers, lobbyists, pundits who do. What follows from this model is tantalizing. If information ceases to be scarce, if it becomes freely and easily available to all, the fundamental problem of existing democratic systems would be solved. And then the dreams of democratic theorists everywhere actually came true. The internet made information abundant. The rise of online news gave Americans access to more information, vastly more information, orders of magnitude more information than they had ever had before. And yet surveys showed we weren't, on average, any more politically informed. Nor were we any more involved. Voter participation didn't show a boost from the democratization of political information. Why? In the early aughts, Princeton political scientist Marcus Pryor set out to unravel this apparent paradox. The way he resolved the problem is, in retrospect, obvious. What the digital information revolution offered wasn't just more information but more choice of information. Yes, there were now more cable news channels, but they were dwarfed in number by the channels that had no interest whatsoever in news channels that served up round-the-clock cooking, home repair, travel, comedy, cartoons, tech, classic LMS. Yes, you could read the political coverage of any newspaper or magazine in the country online, but you could also read so much more non-political coverage. The explosion in political media was more than matched by the explosion in media covering music, television, diets, health, video games, rock climbing, spirituality, celebrity breakups, sports, gardening, cat pictures, genealogical records, really, everything. The key factor now, Pryor argued, was not access to political information, but interest in political information. He made his point by comparing it to television. Like the internet, television multiplied the amount of information available to people, and it spread like wild rye. But unlike the internet, television, at least in its early years, offered little choice. For decades, the network's scheduling ruled out situations in which viewers had to choose between entertainment and news, Pryor wrote in his paper News vs. Entertainment. Largely unexposed to entertainment competition, news had its place in the early evening and again before the late-night shows. Today, as both entertainment and news are available around the clock on numerous cable channels and websites, people's content preferences determine more of what those with cable or internet access watch, read, and hear. One, politics had once been bundled alongside everything else, and even the uninterested were pushed to consume political news. You might subscribe to the newspaper for the sports page, but that meant seeing the political stories on A1. You might own a television because you refused to miss I Love Lucy, but if you had the TV on in the evening, you ended up sitting through the news anyway. The digital revolution offered access to unimaginably vast vistas of information, but just as important, it offered access to unimaginably more choice. And that explosion of choice widened that interested-uninterested divide. Greater choices lets the junkies learn more and the disinterested know less. To test this, Pryor surveyed more than 2,300 people about their content preferences and their political knowledge. And because he was conducting this survey in 2002 and 2003, the early years of the internet and still reasonably early for cable, he was able to survey people who had internet access, those who had cable access, those who had both, and those who had neither. Content preferences, which is to say, how much people wanted to consume political information versus how much they wanted to consume other forms of entertainment, had little effect on the knowledge of those without cable and internet access. Even if you wanted more political information, you didn't have easy access to it, so the interest didn't translate cleanly into information. But among those with cable and internet access, the difference in political knowledge between those with the highest and lowest interest in cable news was 27%. That dwarfed the difference in political knowledge between people with the highest and lowest levels of schooling. In a high-choice environment, people's content preferences become better predictors of political learning than even their level of education, Pryor wrote. We talk a lot about the left-right polarization in the political news. We don't talk enough about the divide that precedes it, the chasm separating the interested from the uninterested. But you can't understand one without the other. To a large degree, one exists because of the other. And remember, Pryor was conducting this research in the early 2000s, before Facebook and Twitter, before mobile internet and YouTube algorithms, before MSNBC's leftward turn, before BuzzFeed and HuffPost, before Breitbart and the alt-right. The internet has become much better at learning what we want and giving us more of it since then. The competition for audience, and the threat to journalistic business models, has become much more intense since then. And all of this has changed both how political news is produced and how it's consumed. Political media is for the politically invested in all the news that's fit to sell, how the market transforms information into news, economist James Hamilton writes, news emerges not from individuals seeking to improve the functioning of democracy but from readers seeking diversion, reporters forging careers, and owners searching for protest too. That's a bit more cynical than I'd be. A lot of us really do want to improve the functioning of democracy, but as a description of the overall economic system that surrounds our work, it's accurate. And as much as we might want to, it's malpractice to try to understand the news without